Okay, this is the time set for oral argument in Sylvanus. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Sylvanus,
okay, versus State, 89445. We've instituted a procedure that you all should be familiar with by now, which is we added 2 minutes to each side, and the first 2 minutes of your remarks are uninterrupted, so we will be quiet for 2 minutes, but then after that, it's fair game. So please approach and let the clerk know how much time you wish to reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Thomas Qualls, and I represent the appellant, Damian Sylvanus. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. A little background. Damian Sylvanus' mental health history dates back to the age of 5. Over his lifetime, he relied on a number of different antipsychotic medications. He has experienced hospitalization at West Hills, was administered Thorazine injections, suffered traumatic abuse as a teen, which added PTSD to his list of issues, and has presented in crisis to mental health facilities any number of times. His documented history of mental health issues include repeated auditory hallucinations and recurring delusions that he is being chased by a gang that wants to torture and kill him. He also has a history of self-medicating with methamphetamine and opioids, and therefore from the ages of 29 to 39 spent more than 11 years in prison, where incidentally his records also show these ongoing delusions and the necessity of ongoing antipsychotic medications even in a controlled environment. He was in a mental health crisis at the time of the events that led to the arrest in this case. In his mind, he was fleeing from that gang that wanted to torture and kill him. In the course of his fleeing, he accidentally drove his vehicle into a ditch, and because he thought the gang would now catch him and torture him, he cut 10 centimeter gashes in each of his arm, trying to kill himself rather than subject himself to this torture. When someone stopped to help him, he begged that person to shoot him. They, of course, backed away from him in fear. He took the person's car and proceeded to flee the gang some more, which is where the eluding charge came from. Dr. Melissa Piasecki evaluated him and determined that he met the three-factor criteria for not guilty by reason of insanity. She testified accordingly to the jury, and the jury returned 2 NGRI verdicts and 1 GBMI verdict, which is why we're here. I should also add that once he was arrested, it took them 8 months of him being in custody for them to stabilize him, find the right medications, and get him to a state where he could go to trial.
Counsel, where's Mr. Sylvanus now?
Mr. Sylvanus is in, as the supplement that the state submitted, is in Lakes Crossing. He has been transported from the prison by NDOC to Lakes Crossing.
So he was paroled, is that right?
Correct.
So that begs the question, right? So what is the relief that you're seeking here today?
So the relief that I'm seeking, and I submitted in my non-opposition to the supplemental appendix, I addressed the issue that I think the court is getting at, which is this moot at this point? And the answer is no, it's not, because the situation that he's in right now, and this wraps in with all of our argument, is that the district court, under the statutes, under our interpretation of the statutes, did not have the authority to order that he go to Lakes Crossing after leaving the prison. There are a number of Nevada Supreme Court cases which address this address the fact that the district court does not, because of the separation of powers in Article 3, the district court does not have the authority to tell NDOC what to do once the person has been sentenced. And this has come up.
Let's assume that's right. What are you asking for?
What I'm asking for today is clarification that the state and the statutes prioritize mental health treatment over incarceration.
So what would happen to Mr. Silvanus tomorrow if we agree with you?
Right now, the danger right now is that I don't believe that he is at Lakes under a lawful order. I don't believe the district court had the authority to say, after you're paroled, you may go there. Right? If the court had followed.
So he would be released? What are you asking for?
I'm not asking for him to be released. I would like for him to be at Lakes under the NGRI statutes, which I think take precedent over the guilty but mentally ill statutes. And under that scenario, he may not be released until he's not a danger to himself or others. This protects him and it protects the community. And because those statutes weren't followed, right now, I don't believe that Lakes Crossing has the lawful authority to hold him. I don't think that they are under the statutory mandate.
So you're asking us to actually order him to be civilly committed at Lakes?
I'm asking for the court to reverse the sentencing order of the district court related to count 3, the guilty but mentally ill count, and to order that a new judgment be entered that follows the mandates of the NGRI statutes so that he would currently be at Lakes under those NGRI statutes, under the mandate that protects both him and the community, because he would not be allowed to be released until there's a determination by the mental health professionals and by the court that he's not a danger to himself or others.
So he's at Lakes. You agree he should be at Lakes, but it's not moot.
It's not moot because I don't believe under the current order, under the current judgment of conviction on count 3, that's not a lawful order. And so he is not currently lawfully in Lakes custody, and they could, because it's not a lawful order, release him. They're not under the mandate that the NGRI statutes require, which is you've got the finding that he has a mental, that he has a legally defined mental illness. And the next step is he must stay there until it's determined that he's not a danger to himself or others, and that has to be determined by the mental health professionals.
Isn't that exactly what the district court ordered in the judgment of conviction?
No, it is not. And also, again, my position is that the court ordered him to go to prison first, and then that NDOC transfer him back to Lakes Crossing. That's an unlawful order, so he's not there under the mandate of the NGRI statutes, as he would have been had the district court placed him on probation with the condition of probation being that those procedures be followed.
Why is that any different if he's now been paroled? You say he should have been on probation so that we could harmonize the two statutes, and I understand that legal point, but time has moved forward, and now he's been paroled, and he has the guilty but mentally ill, I mean, the NGRI's provision remaining. So why would parole be different from probation in terms of the legality of his current placement at Lakes Crossing? I understand that the court's minute order in the appendix is a little ambiguous because it's trying to stand down and say, look, let's let the Supreme Court finish whatever they're doing and then we can act. But I'm puzzled by why you're saying parole and I understand the difference between the two, but in this case, if he's on parole, I don't understand why it's any different than probation for purposes of your argument and the validity of his placement at Lakes.
It's a jurisdictional argument, Your Honor. If he's on probation, he's under the county jurisdiction, which the district court still has authority over.
Okay.
If he's on parole, that is a state of Nevada issue.
So if we wanted to fix this, what would we do? If we wanted to fix this, how would that happen in your estimation? I understand your point. Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. Again, I think the simple answer is that you overturn the judgment of conviction and you say that the legislative history and this court's decision in Finger all point to the fact that we prioritize mental health treatment over incarceration. And I went back and looked at the 2007 legislative session and the Assembly Committee on the Judiciary when...
But before you do that, let's say we disagreed with you, and I'm not saying that we do, but let's say that we did. We don't agree with you that it had to go up to probation to harmonize the two statutes and that the sentence was okay. If that's the case, what should we do now?
I'm not sure I completely understand the question, because if it's the court's position that the order is fine, then nothing changes. But I think he could challenge his custodial status there, because I don't think he's there under a lawful order. Again, it's the separation of powers.
We reject your probation argument.
What's that?
If we reject your argument that the only thing that could have been done was probation, wouldn't his current placement be perfectly appropriate? Or does the same argument apply to you in your mind?
The same argument applies, Your
okay.
Honor.
Okay.
And if I could, I'd like to go back to the 2007 legislative session and the Assembly Judiciary Committee, when the vice chairman of the committee is on record as saying this is when they were reviving the guilty but mentally ill statutes, because Finger did away with them, and the 2003 and 2005 sessions, they couldn't bring it back. 2007, their solution was, if you're found guilty but mentally ill, you will go to treatment first. And then if you're stabilized and found to not be a danger, you will go spend the rest of your penal sentence in prison, if that's a possibility. And the District Attorney's Association is on record as agreeing with that. They think that that's a good solution because they want to bring back guilty but mentally ill. The only reason that that did not happen is, you find out later on in the minutes, is that the fiscal note attached to building a new in-doc facility for this purpose and staffing it was just too great. And that's why the statute ended up like it is, which is, okay, but you're going to receive mental health treatment in the prison.
But isn't it true that the guilty but mentally ill statute didn't exist before 1995?
No, I believe it did exist. What happened was, I think it did actually exist. What happened in 95 is they just did away with the NGRI statutes, and the guilty but mentally ill statutes remain there. What happened in 2001 was this court's decision in Finger, which threw out the whole entire scheme, including the guilty but mentally ill part, and said, you got to go back to the 1995 as far as the NGRI, how it existed at the time.
So if the court, you're saying the district court would have had authority at sentencing to order him to Lakes pursuant to the NGRI statutes and sentence him on the guilty but mentally ill count, but sentence him to if he were put on probation, he would be given a sentence that was suspended to be placed on probation with conditions for a certain amount of time.
Correct.
And you're saying the district court had the authority to order both of those things and place him initially at Lakes Crossing.
I'm not just saying they had the authority, I'm saying they had the mandate. This is a situation in which I believe the legislature removed ordinary sentencing discretion as to this. And this, again, is my argument of the both the plain reading of the statutes and...
What part of the plain reading of the statute says there's no discretion to put someone in prison on a guilty but mentally ill?
Do I have permission to answer that since my time? Okay.
Your three-minute rebuttal time. Go ahead. It's okay.
The NGRI statutes, specific governs over general. That's a well-accepted tenet in statutory interpretation. Specific governs over general, and language like shall and must and the specific time frames of the procedures that have to happen under the NGRI statute.
So there's two shalls. There's a mandate in the NGRI about what happens, and there's a mandate in the GBMI about what happens.
There's not actually a mandate. There's an exception in the GBMI statute. It starts out saying, except as otherwise provided by specific statute. That is the crux right there, and that is the reason why I dug into the history of that statute and reviving it is, what else could this, what could this possibly mean? I mean, the legislature does that all the time when they intend for a general statute to make room for specific statutes. That's how it happens.
How and is so the NGRI statute more specific than the GBMI statute?
As I just stated, it says if you have an NGRI verdict and following that verdict, you've got to take him to Lakes. There's got to be an evaluation within 90 days, and this court's got to decide if he's a person with mental illness under the legal definition.
What if he was found guilty but mentally ill of an offense that wasn't probationable?
You're talking about in a split verdict?
Yes.
Situation?
Yes.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's a great question, but I would say that's one reason why this court should clarify what would happen if there's a mixed verdict like this. I intentionally did not raise the constitutionality of the GBMI statutes or challenge, you know, the sufficiency of the evidence or anything else, because it makes no sense. This was one string of events in this case. It makes no sense that two of the verdicts are NGRI and one is guilty but mentally ill. But I didn't
make that argument.
I didn't go there for strategic reasons to benefit my client. But I do think that there's a problem. And in my briefing, I show the history of the problem. I cite numerous law review articles that, to say, you know, that the GBMI is not only unnecessary, but it probably erodes the fundamental constitutional right that is codified in the NGRI statutes.
Well, you've eaten up all your time, but I'm going to give you two more minutes to add on for rebuttal, and I'll add 2 minutes to the state's time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Amanda Sage on behalf of the State of Nevada. As we just kind of touched on in closing, this case is not about the validity of guilty but mentally ill verdicts generally, or even the guilty but mentally ill verdict in this case. The only question before this Court is whether Nevada's not guilty by reason of insanity statute requires immediate execution of commitment in a way that eliminates sentencing discretion on a separate but valid guilty but mentally ill verdict? And the answer is no. The not guilty by reason of insanity statute requires the courts to make findings of mental illness and to enter a commitment order. They are silent as to sequencing when there are multiple competing custodial orders. Because the not guilty by reason of insanity statute is silent where others are not, the district court retained discretion at sentencing to impose a lawful prison sentence on the guilty but mentally ill count. And once that sentence was imposed, Nevada's sentencing statutes, like NRS 176.335, mandated that the sentence begin immediately. Now, does that mean that the courts have carte blanche authority to delay commitment? Of course not. The order is valid and enforceable once no other barrier to its execution remains. But where, like here, we have competing custodial orders, the not guilty by reason of insanity statute silence does allow each statute involved to be read harmoniously. The lawful prison sentence, which, as I said, must begin immediately on the date of sentence via transport to NDOC without delay, can go into immediate effect as required, and then upon completion, the commitment order takes over to ensure the mentally ill inmate is no longer a danger to himself or to the person or property of others before ultimate discharge. And I think because at its heart, that's what the NGRI statute is about. It's about ensuring that individuals who commit offenses when legally insane, often violent and dangerous offenses like the one here, are safe to reenter the community once that reentry becomes viable.
Counsel, how are we supposed to interpret the language then in the GBMI statute that begins, except as otherwise provided by specific statute? Why could that not be referring to the NGRI statute?
I think it's the language you just quoted, Your Honor, and thank you for the question. It's that specific statute. So when we talk about specific statute, it's saying something that is specifically referencing the GBMI verdicts. And that exists. There are statutes that say, whereas someone found just straight guilty of an offense wouldn't be subject to mental health treatment in prison, there are statutes that reference that you can mandate treatment as part of their imprisonment. That same statute also mandates that if you have to make the mental health finding, which wouldn't occur in a guilty verdict. And so when it says specific statute, it's asking us to look at something that specifically looks at it, not saying that if we perceive there to be some friction elsewhere, we can say that essentially this other thing is going to control. That's not a specific statute.
And I'd just like to clarify that the GBMI statute was added to the laws in 2007, so it was not 2005 or before. So I just want to clarify that for the record.
So I believe it was initially added in 1995. It was removed with the Finger decision when they reverted back to when it was just NGRI, and then, yes, reinstated in 2007.
So what should we do at this point with this case? He has been paroled, and he's at Lakes Crossing. It strikes me that the issues are moot, although I do take Mr. Qualls' point about competing jurisdictional authority. But what would, if you were to write an order in this case, what would you say?
Well, my order in this case would just be to affirm the judgment of conviction and find that the prison sentence was allowed to lawfully occur sequentially before the NGRI commitment.
What do you do with his issue with respect to the legality of his, as a practical matter, he's okay, as I understand it, with him being at Lakes Crossing, but he's concerned about the legality of the judgment of conviction insofar as it orders that placement.
And I think that just gets back to the underlying question in this case. Could the judge sequence them the way they did? And if this court finds that, yes, that sequencing was proper, then the placement to the Lakes Crossing once the prison sentence was over was legally valid. It's not an illegal order.
But if you credit his point, then where are we in terms of mootness?
In which point is that, sorry, Your Honor?
His point being that the argument that under the statutes the only permissible sentence was probation, never mind Justice Kadish's point about non-probational offenses. But if we do that, if he was right that was the only thing that could have happened, where would we be at this point?
I do tend to agree with his jurisdictional question that parole and probation are jurisdictionally different. They also have different supervision requirements that accompany them and what can happen and how we are treated as far as what's a parole violation versus what's a probation violation is obviously very different. And so with what the remedy in this case being that it be remanded and that this court find that probation was mandatory, I do think it would still have some effect for now. I think we are on a timeline where mootness could certainly become more of an issue. My understanding is he's expected to expire his prison sentence in May. And once that occurs, I'm not sure that we could go back and do probation. The question does become moot.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so now to Justice Kadish's point, when we talk about plain language of statutes, and I think really this case does rest on the plain language of statutes. You've been given two options. The state's option allows for these statutes to be read harmoniously. Mr. Silvanus's suggestion would require this court to render multiple statutory provisions null and unenforceable. It's inconsistent with the express language, for example, in Chapter 176A that talks about probation being mandatory and within the sound discretion of the district courts unless otherwise specifically discussed for. And we see here that the legislature, when they want to limit probation as an option, they explicitly do it. For example, Category E offenses are often probation mandatory. Certain drug offenses are often probation mandatory. When probation is unavailable, they do the same thing. We have DUI offenses, domestic violence offenses, where prison is mandatory. And this gets to the point from Justice Kadish that we can certainly envision a situation where someone was found guilty but mentally ill of something that required prison. Maybe it's a life sentence or just a prison mandatory case, in which case the analysis from Mr. Silvanus and the position he puts forward falls apart because now we would be requiring courts to ignore an express mandate from the legislature that prison must be imposed for these valid sentences and valid convictions. And when we talk about statutory construction, when one of the main goals is if can we interpret these rules in harmony with other rules or statutes, we should be doing that. It's the state's position that its reading allows that harmonious reading across all of the sentencing statutes. And I want to be clear that the district court, having that discretion, exercised it here. She considered whether probation might be appropriate in this case. It was a viable, available option. But she found that given his criminal history, which involved robbery, unlawfully possessing firearms, DUIs, given the danger that he created here with the eluding, where he almost T-boned a Reno City community bus, and he was going the wrong way on a freeway, and then also leaned heavily into Mr. Silvanus' own testimony, where he said where he was most stable, where he was doing best, was when he was in prison and medicated, that there was a period of time where he got out of prison and was medicated and was doing well. He was holding a job and stable, and then he voluntarily stopped taking those medications. And that was one of her concerns. If he can stop taking his medications, and then what we see follow is the behavior like that occurred here, prison was appropriate and not probation. And so she exercised that appropriate discretion. And so then again, once she was able to exercise that discretion, we get into the sequencing question. In what sequencing order do these have to occur? And it's the state's position that because the not guilty by reason of insanity statute is silent as to sequencing, when we have other statutes that mandate certain things happen immediately, like judgment of convictions and imprisonment do, that those have to control. That doesn't invalidate the NGRI commitment. It just says we have a list of valid custodial orders and this is where it's going to fall. And we see that all the time in criminal cases. You may have somebody released on their own recognizance in one action but still held on bail in the other. They don't get sent out into the community just because of this own recognizance release. They're still held on their bail. We see it when, you know, someone gets a prison sentence. It has to start immediately, even though they may have something else pending in the district court. They're often sent off to prison and then brought back. So we see that sequencing. That's not a new concept. And again, because the NGRI statute doesn't say it supplants these other areas explicitly, even though the legislature has shown they're able to do so when they want, then we can allow that prison sentence to go first. The district court can do exactly what it did and say now that this determination of release into the community is viable, he served his prison sentence, we do that commitment and we make sure that at that time he is safe for that return to the community. Now again, the state's position is that this can all be resolved with the plain language of the statute. It is not ambiguous when they're all read together. Mr. Silvanus' reading of the statute, I would argue, is not a plain language reading because it requires nullifying language and, in fact, inserting language where it otherwise doesn't exist. But I also want to point or make the point that if we do move beyond the plain language reading, if this court were to find some ambiguity, the opening brief seems to suggest that we would jump straight to the rule of lenity, which, of course, under statutory construction principles, we don't. There are several steps that we would take before that. One of those is that we can look at related statutes and how the legislature has treated similar situations or comparable situations. And that's where the state brought up competency. Not because this is a competency case, but because I think it illustrates that when the state intends, when the legislature intends mental health to take precedent or treatment, to take precedent over other pending matters, it explicitly does so. The competency statute in 178, which is the same chapter that NGRI procedures are located in, talks about that if someone is found incompetent in one proceeding, all other proceedings against that defendant must be suspended in order to retain or return him to competency. That means if he has a case in justice court, a separate case pending, that's going to get stayed while the competency question is resolved. They didn't do that with NGRI. So again, we know they can. We know they have. They didn't in this case. And ultimately, I think that comes back to the purpose of the NGRI statute, which I alluded to in my opening. At its core, the NGRI statute is not a treatment statute. It's a release statute. It's a safe release statute. Treatment absolutely can be a component of that, but it isn't always. There are cases where if they find this person is not someone with mental illness, they're discharged immediately. And there's nothing that even controls if it's someone with, say, a learning disability, that they're getting mental health treatment. It's just we have to get them to a point where they're not a danger to themselves or others. And so I think that all comports together where, again, I think it presents an idle question, and it doesn't need to be answered whether they're safe until they're actually at risk of being in the community. Finally, there was some discussion about the Finger case and suggesting that in the 2003 session when the statutes on NGRI reverted back to the pre-1995 amendments, that the intent was the NGRI statute's commitment go into effect immediately based on language in Finger and based on some of the legislative history in 2003. And I would argue that that's not accurate. In fact, the Finger case talked about how historically that may have been what happened, but it was in the context of someone was just found NGRI. They weren't looking at these mixed verdict type situations. Interestingly, also, the Finger case did not invalidate guilty but mentally ill verdicts. In fact, the case talks about some of the usefulness of guilty but mentally ill verdicts. The problem was that it was so intertwined in the otherwise unconstitutional removal of NGRI in this case that the court felt like they had to just undo that whole, I think it was Senate Bill 314, revert back. And what you see from the legislatures and legislative history, especially in 2007 when they brought this back, is they discussed how in 2003 they knew that they needed to do something in response to the Finger decision. It wasn't that pre-Finger or pre-1995 just immediately became into effect. In fact, they acknowledged in their committee notes on April 26th that if they do nothing, they're just left with the Supreme Court decision, so they really needed to work and craft an NGRI process that was otherwise that addressed some of their concerns. And so they did things like they added new procedures. They added the mental illness determination that has to occur upon an NGRI. They added discharge procedures that weren't there pre-1995. So to say that what happened in 2003 is we just went back to pre-1995 unequivocally is not accurate. The legislature expressed their desire to make certain changes, to streamline processes, to make processes clearer. And so I don't think we can read immediate into their intent when they didn't just go right back.
So I just want to clarify or talk through what the NGRI process, right? Mm-hmm. So here, the jury found Mr. Silvanus not guilty by reason of insanity as to counts 1 and 2.
Correct.
Which, in a sense, equates to an acquittal, and in fact, there is a judgment of acquittal was actually filed on those counts.
Correct.
So he wasn't going to be criminally punished on those two counts after that, but because of what happened that brought him to an NGRI verdict, he gets evaluated and can't be released unless he's not a danger. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the statute specifically mandates that that evaluation occur within 90 days of the acquittal. So that happened in this case. Interestingly, he would have had to have that evaluation as well for the guilty but mentally ill statute, because it also requires a finding of if he's mentally ill.
Right.
So that was going to happen regardless,
right,
in this case. And
the court found that he was, at the time of sentencing, mentally ill.
Correct.
And based on that finding, ordered that he receive treatment while in NDOC.
Correct, as part of the guilty but mentally ill verdict.
Right.
Yes. And then also ordered that upon completion of the prison sentence, he be transported for further evaluation pursuant to that NGRI statute.
So the prison sentence is a criminal penalty for a criminal conviction.
Correct.
Placement at Lakes is a
civil
commitment to make sure he's not a danger before he's released because he was acquitted of those counts, but because of insanity.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Exactly. And that's what they're doing now. So as we can see, this played out exactly as the district court envisioned. He served his prison sentence. Once that was completed, he was transported to Lakes Crossing in order to undergo that initial evaluation period. And then that triggers the procedural rules in Chapter 178, where they have the 60-day hearing, and they make those determinations with whether now, when he truly is available to be released, is he safe to be in the community, either to himself or to others.
Do you agree with the defense that if this is moot, it is something of widespread importance that is capable of repetition yet evading review? In other words, do you think that exception applies here, and why or why not?
I think this is such a fact-specific situation, and there's so many permutations of what can happen in an NGRI verdict. And given the incredible infrequency of NGRI verdicts, they are incredibly rare. I don't believe that this is necessarily something that is going to, that we're going to see a risk of repetition.
How common are the combination that you've seen in this case where you have guilty but mentally ill, a split verdict, if you will?
So uncommon, I was unable to find a Nevada case that addressed this specific issue. And even looking to other jurisdictions, it was incredibly difficult to find cases that addressed this specific issue. I believe there was one in Ohio, one in Michigan. Both of those, I think, actually reached similar conclusions. The Ohio court was addressing a separate question about that 90-day initial mental health determination and whether it can be skipped, and said it couldn't, which I would agree our laws say the same. So I would say it's incredibly rare. It doesn't come up here. It rarely comes up across the country. And so it's not something that I think is easily repeatable as far as mootness concerns go.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Your Honor, I would just close and say that the defense asked this court to impose a mandatory sequencing rule that eliminates sentencing discretion, where the legislature took no such action and would lead to absurd results, especially in cases where prison is mandatory. Therefore, this court should decline that invitation and affirm the judgment of conviction in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Qualls, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And 2 seconds.
And 2 seconds. Thank you.
Use them well.
I want to read from Justice Levitt's concurring opinion in Finger first. Quote, persons who may be incapable of committing crime because of mental illness should not be placed in prison with criminals who intentionally, willfully, and knowingly commit crime. Such inflicted punishment is cruel and unusual in violation of the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And that strikes at the heart of the issue here, which is we, in Finger and in the statutes and as a society, we have decided that those that are so profoundly mentally ill that they cannot appreciate the wrongfulness of their acts cannot be punished by being put in prison. They require special treatment, and that treatment takes priority. And that priority, that elevation to a fundamental right that we all have that is protected by the Due Process Clause of the U.S. and Nevada constitutions, that takes preeminence over possible punishment. And that is the tension and the conflict between the GBMI statutes and then the NGRI statutes. And to answer your question earlier, Justice Kadish, that may be part of this court's order, is to try and suss out that conflict and mandate that the legislature fix that. Because
we can order the legislature to do something?
Well, you could throw it out like the statutes were in Finger and say, please fix this.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right.
Thank you.
Bad choice of words.
That's fine.
I would also say that another crux of this issue is that there is no way to read the NGRI statutes in the way that the district court did, as allowing prison in between evaluation and commitment.
Very well.
My time's up.
It is.
Thank you, Your Honor.